Part 4, What Will It Take? How will we find a way out? We walk and talk with Babylon's mouth. Faith Nolan. In her song, How Will We Find a Way Out?, Faith Nolan wonders how we can create a new society when every aspect of our lives is shaped by the old one. The answer to this question lies in the question itself. Those who are completely dominated do not question the way things are. Questioning reveals a desire for change. The last part of this book shows how the elements of a new society exist within the old, creating pressure for change. At some point in their development, all species face problems that they must solve or they will perish. The most important question humanity faces today is the question of power. Who will control society, the minority or the majority? Part 4 explains how humanity can break free of capitalism and create a classless society based on equality, reciprocity, and cooperation. Chapter 13, Decide Which Side You're On, explains why we must take sides. Chapter 14, Seize the Power, shows how the working class could take control of society. Chapter 15, Beware the Middle Ground, reveals the danger of compromise. Chapter 16, Claim the Surplus, outlines the prospect of producing for human need. Chapter 13, Decide Which Side You're On. I don't believe it's possible to be neutral. The world is already moving in certain directions. Wars are going on. Children are starving. And to be neutral, to not take a stand in a situation like that, is to collaborate with whatever is going on to allow it to happen. Howard Zinn. Why do we have to take sides? Wouldn't everyone benefit from an end to famine, preventable disease, pollution, and war? It's a lovely thought. However, class divisions exist because the two major classes have conflicting goals. The prime directive of the capitalist class is to seize the surplus at the expense of the working class, which can resist only by raising its own demand, share. Because it is impossible to seize the surplus and to share it at the same time, only one class can rule. Which one should it be? This chapter explores which class best represents the interests of humanity. Defining class. 40% of Americans think that it's easier to move up the class ladder now than it was 30 years ago. America is described as the land of opportunity where people can better themselves if they try hard enough. In reality, fewer American families improved their conditions over the 1980s compared with the 1970s, and even fewer moved up during the 1990s. Between 1980 and 2002, the proportion of U.S. income earned by 90% of the population fell, while the share going to the top 0.1% more than doubled. Stories of individual success support the myth of upward mobility. A newspaper article titled, McJob Can Lead to Career, McDonald's Employee Worked His Way Up, highlights Glenn Stevens, a top McDonald's executive who started off as a restaurant worker. The message is that entry-level jobs can lead to professional careers for those with the right stuff. Lotteries use the same logic. Someone has to win, why not you? In reality, corporations hire few executives, and even fewer people win lotteries. Nevertheless, the lure of success draws many into a game that enriches only a few. No matter how hard people work, a hierarchical society cannot provide a decent life for all. A 2005 investigation by the New York Times concluded, class is still a powerful force in American life. Over the past three decades, it has come to play a greater, not lesser, role in important ways. Those who insist that you can't reduce everything to class fail to understand how profoundly class affects every aspect of life, from birth to death. Health and lifespan decline as you go down the social ladder. Raising children is much easier with nannies, maids, and regular vacations. Retirement with health and wealth is very different from retirement with neither. The poor are hit harder by economic recessions and natural disasters. Earthquakes, hurricanes, and tidal waves that devastate trailer parks spare the sturdy homes of the wealthy. The existence of inequality cannot be disputed. However, what class means is highly disputed. In the United States, those who are neither very rich nor very poor are generally assumed to be middle class. According to author Lillian Rubin, all the talk about the middle class serves to obscure class realities rather than to clarify them. To acknowledge the existence of a working class challenges the long-held American fiction that this nation has conquered the invidious distinction of class. Instead, the political rhetoric supports and strengthens the myth that we are a classless society. Close quote. Class is commonly defined by a person's income, wealth, education, and occupation. However, these categories are not useful. Unionized factory workers can make more money than middle-class professionals. Top athletes can acquire larger fortunes than Pentagon generals, and skilled workers can be more educated than small business owners. A gardener could be a unionized worker or own a business, and the category of white collar includes the filing clerk and the chartered accountant. Many people think that class is too complicated to define. It doesn't have to be. Human beings are a social species, and class is a social relationship. Individual characteristics, like a person's income, wealth, education, and occupation, tell us nothing about a person's relationship to others and to society. We need a social definition of class. Historically, people have created different social arrangements to secure the necessities of life and raise the next generation. In pre-class, egalitarian societies, everyone shared the work. Sharing the work means sharing the decisions about what will be done, how it will be done, and who will benefit. In class societies, most people work, and a few live off their labor. The people at the top make the decisions, and everyone else carries them out. The questions of work and power are central to both social arrangements. A social-based definition of class would measure two variables: the control that people have over their work and the control that they have over other people's work. Using this criteria, we can divide modern society into three classes: the class that rules, the capitalist class; the class that obeys, the working class; and the class in the middle, the middle class. The following sections flesh out these definitions. The class that rules. The capitalist class, also called the ruling class, has the most power because it owns or controls the natural resources required to create wealth, the labor process of creating wealth, and the wealth that is created. Seize the surplus. Because it controls all of these things, a capitalist class decides the overall direction of society, determining what will be produced, how it will be produced, and who will have access to the resulting goods and services. The values of the capitalist class also dominate society. This class has the power to launch a war and to pay for that war by gutting social programs. People in the capitalist class include the CEOs of the largest corporations, the presidents and directors of the largest universities and banks, and the highest-ranking politicians, government bureaucrats, judges, and military officers. Each nation has its own capitalist class, and together they form a global capitalist class. Capitalists are in constant competition for capital. Larger corporations swallow up smaller ones and grow larger. Stronger nations dominate weaker ones and grow stronger. Ceaseless competition has caused the ruling class to shrink in size while it grows in wealth and power. By 2005, 1% of people at the top of society owned 1/3 of America's financial wealth. The class that obeys. The capitalist class controls the means of production. The working class sets it in motion. Although it creates all the wealth in society, the working class has the least power. People in the working class own no land, no factories, no machines, no businesses, nor any other means of making a living. They can, of course, own personal property, such as home and vehicle. Workers can survive only by selling their ability to labor in exchange for a wage. They have no control over how they produce and what they produce. They have no control over the labor of others. Some people argue that workers can buy into capitalism by purchasing company stocks. In fact, most stocks and bonds are owned by the top 10% of the population. Furthermore, owning shares does not give people the power to control corporate decisions. Employees who owned shares in United Airlines were powerless to stop the restructuring that cost them their jobs, benefits, and pensions. While the ruling class has shrunk over time, the working class has grown in size. More than half the global population is urban working class, with the next largest group being small farmers who are middle class because they own a little land. In the United States, about 80% of the population is working class, the vast majority. The working class includes clerks, receptionists, bookkeepers, cleaners, janitors, cashiers, paramedics, miners, telephone operators, service technicians, mechanics, bank tellers, and also factory, farm, retail, restaurant, hotel, construction, and transport workers. Over the past 50 years, the composition of the working class has changed. Rising productivity has made it possible to accumulate more surplus from fewer workers. Some of this surplus was used to expand the service sector, finance, transportation, hotels, restaurants, and the education, medical, and penal systems. This shift in capital caused the proportion of industrial workers to fall and the proportion of service workers to rise. Both industrial and service workers are working class. Neither group controls the condition of its own work or the work of others. Workers' efforts to exert some control over their work through unions will be discussed later on. The class in the middle. The middle class is the second largest social class. Forming about 20% of the North American population, the middle class sits between the two other classes, blending into the capitalist class at one end and the working class at the other end. People in the middle class have an intermediate level of power, having some control over their own work and some control over the work of others. The middle class owns or controls some means of production. The small farmer owns some land. The self-employed artisan owns some tools. The corner store retailer buys and sells produce. Sections of the middle class employ and exploit workers on a small scale. The 18th century middle class was composed primarily of small farmers and fishermen, artisans, entertainers, lower-level clergy, traders, and owners of small businesses. As capitalism developed, it concentrated capital in fewer hands, obliterating much of the traditional middle class. This process continues today. Giant agricultural corporations' agribusiness swallow family farms, forcing people off their land and into the cities. Fast food chains replace family restaurants. Factories flood the market with cheap, mass-produced goods, pushing skilled craftspeople to the fringe of the economy. With no family business to inherit, children of the traditional middle class have gone to work for the same corporations that put their parents out of business. Some become middle-class managers and professionals. Modern industry has expanded the role of the salaried professional. The owner of a small factory can personally direct every worker. In large industries, many supervisors are needed to oversee the work of hundreds or thousands of workers. Supervision is needed because bosses and workers have opposite goals. Bosses want workers to produce as much as possible to boost profits. Workers want to slow down to preserve their health. Bosses want to lower wages to cut costs. Workers want higher wages so they can pay their bills. Because the capitalist can stay in business only by forcing the worker to produce more and to surrender more of the value of what she produces. The worker will always resist producing for the capitalist. The job of middle managers is to impose the will of the boss on the workers, to make sure the workers never think they have the right or the ability to control what happens in the workplace. The capitalist also needs middle-class financial, legal, scientific, design, and technical experts to find ways to increase profits. While ordinary workers are micromanaged, salaried professionals are encouraged to think creatively and act independently within the limits set by the boss. How professionals are trained to do this is explained later on. Middle-class managers, supervisors, foremen, overseers, and professionals can be distinguished from wage workers by the amount of control they exercise in the workplace. A unionized electrician on a construction site could be more educated, more skilled, and make more money than the site supervisor. However, the supervisor tells the electrician what to do. The supervisor has the power to schedule work, and some have the power to hire and fire. In turn, the supervisor is under the control of the big boss and keeps his job only as long as he carries out the boss's wishes. The gray zones. An indeterminate number of people inhabit the two gray zones on either edge of the middle class. The zone between the middle and ruling classes includes members of the ruling class who perform upper-level managerial functions and upper-level managers who are occasionally invited to make big decisions. This layer is of little interest in our discussion. There is a much larger gray zone between the middle and working classes. At one end are middle-class professionals whose degraded working conditions resemble industrial assembly lines. Physicians working for health management organizations, HMOs, are permitted to order only those tests and provide only those treatments that an employer approves. By removing their decision-making functions, HMOs force doctors into working-class conditions. In response, thousands of doctors have joined unions and organized collective bargaining units recognized by the National Labor Relations Board. At the other end of the zone, between the working and middle classes, are waged workers with small businesses on the side, like the bookkeeper with a weekend gig in a dance band. People in the gray zone may alternate between working for others and working for themselves. Consider the restaurant worker with a small catering business on the side. If her business does well, she may hire an apprentice and move into the middle class. If she drops her business to work full-time at the restaurant, she moves back into the working class. The prostitute who works for herself is middle class. The one who works for a pimp is working class. When it is difficult to decide if someone is middle or working class, that person is most likely in the gray zone. Blended class families are formed when middle and working class people marry. A doctor marries a secretary, a musician marries a truck driver, a minister marries a miner. Changes of fortune also create blended class families. The disbarred lawyer takes a job at the post office, and the steelworker's daughter goes to medical school. The gray zone also includes workers who perform managerial functions. These include salaried social workers, nurses, grade school teachers, prison guards, and active duty soldiers. All are working class because they have little or no control over their own working conditions. At the same time, their jobs give them some control over others. Chapter 12 described how social workers can support or destroy the lives of people who have even less power. Teachers have power over their students, grooming some for success and abandoning others to failure. Nevertheless, most teachers are working class. They are restricted to an established curriculum, and like their students, their days are regimented to the sound of the bell. In contrast, middle-class university professors generally have more freedom to choose what they teach and how they teach it. Professors also exercise power over other workers, in particular graduate student teaching assistants. Grade school teachers have no authority over other school employees. Ordinarily, soldiers are working class because they have absolutely no control over the conditions of their work. At the same time, the active duty soldier has a middle class function, to control others. Soldiers are not in the same class as police officers. The working class soldier is drilled to follow commands without thinking, while the police officer is a middle class professional who is trusted by the higher-ups to know who to target, who to charge, who can be roughed up, and whose life has less value. When workers who perform managerial functions rebel, they can really rattle the system. Under normal conditions, teachers indoctrinate their students with the values of capitalism. When teachers press for higher wages and better working conditions, they become role models for rebellion. The same holds true for social workers who demand more funds for social services. Soldiers who switch sides can stop wars and topple ruling classes. In 1917, Russian soldiers joined with other workers to pull Russia out of the First World War. A few months later, German sailors sparked a revolution that forced the Kaiser to abdicate and effectively ended the war. In the 1960s, rebelling U.S. soldiers in Vietnam dealt a serious blow to the American empire. Unions. Workers formed unions to protect themselves from the insatiable demands of employers. A union worker is more likely to have medical coverage, pension benefits, and protection from sexual harassment and wrongful discipline or dismissal. Compared with states with fewer unions, states with more unions enjoy higher wages, more medical coverage, higher life expectancy, lower infant mortality, less poverty, more money for education, and lower workplace fatalities for everyone. Patients also do better in hospitals where nurses are unionized. Sadly, the unions of today are a pale shadow of what they used to be. Janora Johnson Dollinger describes the confidence of auto workers who organized General Motors in 1937. Quote, every time something came up that couldn't be settled, or the workers got a tough foreman who told them to go to hell, they'd shut down the line. The men were so cocky, they'd say to the foreman, "You don't like it?" They'd push the button and shut down the line. Close quote. The power of organized workers frightened and enraged the capitalists, who realized the only way to tame the unions was to gut them of socialists and other class-conscious militants. With the support of President Roosevelt, employers began to attack unions and union organizers. In 1938, Congress formed the Special Committee on Un-American Activities to rout out, quote, radical subversives. In Subterranean Fire, A History of Working-Class Radicalism in the United States, Sharon Smith explains how conservative union officials worked hand in hand with the state to drive socialists out of the unions. Stripped of their fighting core, unions were transformed from fighting organizations controlled by workers into bureaucratic organizations run by middle-class professionals. There are middle-class unions composed of police, doctors, and other professionals. However, most unions function within the gray zone between the classes. Unions are working-class organizations of self-defense and are also part of the management system of capitalism. Most ordinary union members, known as the rank and file, are working-class people, while union officials are mostly middle-class professionals. The job of these officials is to mediate between bosses and workers to negotiate the terms on which workers will be exploited. Most unions have a large working class base and a much smaller middle class leadership. Workers who get a few hours off of work to conduct union business are still working class. Even some full-time union organizers are working class because they are kept on a short leash by union officials. Other organizers are trusted to know the rules of the game and to make the right decisions, like any other middle-class professional. The higher someone rises in the union hierarchy, the more managerial functions that person performs. Union officials with the power to hire and fire clerical and other support staff are solidly middle class. Top union officials who help the government set policy are upper middle class. Union officials, also called union bureaucrats, have the same goal as employers, keeping the company in business. And that means keeping it competitive. The website of America's largest union organization, the AFL-CIO, boasts that, quote, unions are good for productivity. Unions increase productivity according to most recent studies. The voice that union members have on the job, sharing in decision-making about promotions and work and production standards, increases productivity and improves management practices. Better training, lower turnover, and longer tenure also make union workers up to 38% more productive, close quote. In reality, productivity can increase only by reducing the amount of surplus that goes to the workers who produce it. From the 1940s through the 1960s, unions supported management drives to raise productivity and profits, bargaining away workers' control on the job in exchange for higher wages and better benefits. This changed in the 1970s when employers declared war on the working class to push productivity even higher. Most unions did not fight back because the tradition of fighting back was lost when militants were purged from the unions. Union officials agreed to help employers downsize and restructure in the hope that if workers helped companies to become more profitable, companies would reciprocate by rewarding workers for their sacrifice. Unfortunately, capitalism is not based on reciprocity, but on seize the surplus. The more profits rose, the more employers demanded. At each step of this process, union officials protested loudly, then conceded to the employers' demands. As the economy boomed, workers' conditions deteriorated. Some unions did fight. In December of 1984, members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, UFCW, decided not to accept wage cuts at their meatpacking plant in Minnesota. In hard-pressed in the heartland, the Hormel strike and the future of the labor movement, Peter Ratchlove writes, quote, "Over the first half of the 1980s, no local had been able to stand up to the corporate pressure for concessions or the international union's acquiescence. Local P9's willingness to take a stand thus threatened the international union nearly as much as it threatened the Hormel Corporation. P9 quickly came to symbolize democracy and membership participation, a willingness to oppose corporate demands for concessions, regardless of international union agendas or strategies, and a form of horizontal solidarity that threatened the vertical, bureaucratic hold that international unions exercised over their locals. As thousands of workers poured into Austin to express their support, we likened their experience to catching a virus from P9. But the UFCW and the AFL-CIO were determined to prevent the spread of this virus." Close quote. In May of 1985, the executive board of the UFCW removed the elected leadership of Local P9 and put a union bureaucrat in charge. As the new local president, Joe Hansen signed Hormel's concession contract. While conditions in the meatpacking industry continue to deteriorate, Hansen defends his role in the P9 strike, stating, quote, "It's because of me that there's still a union in that plant," close quote. In fact, concession contracts do not preserve unions. By 2005, the percentage of private sector workers in unions had dropped to under 8%, the lowest rate in more than a century. In 2005, the crisis in the labor movement provoked a split in the AFL-CIO. While both sides of this split pledged to organize more workers into unions, neither is committed to fighting the employers. Strikes deplete union funds and risk driving the employer out of business or out of town. As long as union officials accept the logic of capitalism, they will inevitably side with management to put profit before human needs. In any sane world, a social system that could not function without eroding people's living standards would be replaced. Instead of taking that road, union bureaucrats lower their members' expectations of what can be achieved. The union bureaucracy is a managerial class that fears rousing the rank and file. At times, union officials will talk tough and even lead militant struggles, only to crumble under employer pressure. When workers rebel in wildcat strikes, union officials do everything they can to get workers back on the job. Some people think that unions have become so corrupt and useless that they are not worth defending. This is a big mistake. The capitalist class continues to attack unions because they stand in the way of bosses having complete control over the workplace. Workers need unions, and unions must be defended against those who would destroy them. The best defense would be for workers to take collective control of their unions and transform them into fighting organizations that can win real gains for working people. More on this later. A few solid labor victories would energize the entire working class and raise expectations of what can be achieved. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Unions and the State. Just as union officials partner with employers to manage the workplace, America's top union bureaucrats partner with the American state to manage the world. Without the awareness or consent of their members, top executives in the AFL-CIO have helped to overthrow democratically elected governments, prop up anti-union dictators, support right-wing unions against progressive governments. Kim Sipes found that, quote, "Before the First World War, the American Federation of Labor engaged in counteracting revolutionary forces in Mexico during that country's revolution, actively worked to support and defend U.S. government participation in the First World War, and then led the charge within U.S. foreign policy circles against the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia." The AFL-CIO established its own Latin American operation in 1962, the American Institute for Free Labor Development, to better respond to challenges within the region. Among other activities, AIFLD helped lay the groundwork for the military coups against democratically elected governments in Guatemala in 1954, Brazil in 1964, and Chile in 1973. These efforts in Latin America were paralleled in Africa and Asia, close quote. In 1999, the Advisory Committee on Labor Diplomacy, ACLD, was established as a forum for top labor leaders to advise the federal government. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright addressed one ACLD meeting, quote, "When you undertook your lives as labor leaders, becoming a part of the U.S. government may have not been something that you intended, but I do think it has been a very important partnership. I think that is the best way to describe it." Close quote. Sections of the labor movement have protested union support for U.S. imperialism. The California Federation of Labor publicly criticized the AFL-CIO for backing right-wing organizations that tried to oust Venezuela's elected president, Hugo Chavez. The class conflict between union officials and rank-and-file workers is expressed in this statement from the South Bay Labor Council. Quote, "There's no solidarity when labor becomes a go-between, laundering funds and resources from the Bush administration and passing them to groups abroad. That role is more appropriate for government agents, agents of empire. We believe that international labor solidarity must come from the heart of the workers in one country to the heart of the workers in another country, a reciprocal relationship. Close quote. Class and consciousness. The capitalist class benefits from exploiting the working class. The working class benefits when it resists the capitalist class. The middle class vacillates, supporting one class and then the other, or both, at the same time. The question immediately arises, if the working class is the majority of society, creating all the wealth of society, why does it allow the capitalist class to exploit it? Part 3 explained how the capitalist class imposes its will on society through outright lies, by blaming the victim, through divide and rule, and by assaulting children. These methods succeed only because people can be bamboozled into thinking that their enemies are really their friends. The flexibility of human consciousness is both a strength and a weakness. The ability to learn, change, and adapt is a strength. The capacity to be deceived is a weakness. As every con artist knows, people can be deceived into acting against their own interests. Priests convince women that using birth control is sinful, and politicians convince the poor to kill each other in wars that benefit the rich. People can also resist indoctrination. Most Catholics use birth control despite church doctrine. And American sailor Pablo Paredes preferred to go to prison than to fight an immoral war in Iraq. People can choose what they think. However, they don't choose in a vacuum. People in different social classes have different life experiences that influence what they believe. A rich person's experience of being served feeds the belief that she is a superior being. A working woman's life of drudgery feeds the belief that she doesn't deserve better. A shopkeeper's frustration with her employees feeds the belief that workers are lazy and irresponsible. A worker's life of hard work and low pay feeds anger and bitterness. Even though class strongly influences what people believe, class does not determine consciousness. In theory, anyone from any class can believe anything. To stay in power, the capitalist class must ensure that certain ideas, like private property and inequality, dominate society. However, the ideas that support the capitalist system conflict with most people's experience. The belief that hard work will lead to a better life conflicts with the reality of working 2 and 3 jobs for minimum wage and getting nowhere. The belief that the people in charge are superior conflicts with their obvious incompetence when it comes to practical matters. The capitalist class faces a huge challenge. It must coerce workers into disregarding their own experience in order to view themselves and the world through the eyes of their oppressors. The conflict between the classes must be transformed into a conflict inside the worker, causing confusion and internal doubt. The resulting lack of confidence helps keep workers subordinate. Class conflict is rooted in the fact that one class does the work and a different class reaps the benefits. To maintain this inequality, the ruling class promotes the view that everyone has the same interests, that class conflict is no more than an attitude or a state of mind. In reality, as long as humanity is divided into antagonistic classes, people will have to take sides. Those who advocate class neutrality are not neutral at all. They support the status quo that favors the capitalist class. Consider a nurse's strike. Management accuses nurses of harming patients by withdrawing services. Nurses condemn management for harming patients by not hiring enough staff. Both sides claim to represent the patient's interests. Which side would you support? If the hospital were a metaphor for society, would you be on the side of the capitalist class or the working class? Capitalists insist that what is good for business is good for society. Workers insist that what is good for workers is good for society. Capitalists want a world where profits keep climbing and they are firmly in control. The capitalist dream is a nightmare for workers who long for meaningful work and freedom from authoritarian control. The middle class can see both sides and advocates compromise. However, the rule of compete or die makes compromise impossible. The employer who agrees to pay higher wages will fall behind his competitor who refuses to compromise. Workers who curb their demands find the employer demanding even more to stay competitive. As long as the two classes are locked in combat over the surplus, there are only three choices: to side with the ruling class, to side with the working class, or vacillate with the middle class. Let's examine which class best represents the interest of humanity, starting with a class in power. More of the same? Despite having all the resources of society at its command, the ruling class is incapable of solving basic problems for two reasons: seize the surplus and compete or die. Because these two commandments rule society, problems become important only when there is profit to be made or when a threat to profit must be averted. Nothing else matters. Consider how the capitalist class responds to epidemics. The HIV/AIDS epidemic emerged in the mid-1970s in Africa, where it fed on widespread poverty and the devastation of war. Although the disease is preventable and treatable, the rulers of the world have failed to devote sufficient resources to solve the problem. By 2005, more than 20 million people were dead, a further 40 million were infected, and more than 12 million children have been orphaned. As the epidemic continues to grow, the U.S. Council on Foreign Relations warns, quote, "The scale and geographic scope of the HIV/AIDS pandemic has only two parallels in recorded history, the 1918 flu pandemic and the Black Death in the 14th century." Close quote. In 1996, a potent combination of antiviral drugs caused a sharp drop in the number of people dying from AIDS in the United States. In 2003, the World Health Organization, WHO, launched a campaign to provide this new treatment to half of the 6 million people in the world with AIDS. Unfortunately, the rules of capitalism do not allow people to be given the medicine they need. They have to buy it. WHO raised enough money to buy treatment for only 1 million people. To protect drug company profits, 5 million people were left to die. In a vicious cycle of deprivation and disease, capitalism increases inequality. Inequality creates the conditions for disease, and the refusal to invest in human health contributes to the spread of disease. As the pandemic grows, the response of world leaders continues to be haphazard and ineffective. Stephen Lewis, United States Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS, expresses a frustration felt by many. Quote, "People are dying at a rate of 3 million a year, and we have the capacity to keep them alive, and we can't summon sufficient resources." Close quote. The response to future epidemics will be no different. As Mike Davis points out, quote, "The threat of avian influenza maps with uncanny accuracy the global topography of inequality, debt, and poverty. Like HIV/AIDS, avian flu is a plague that grows directly out of the new ecology of globalization, the world public health crisis, and the obscene misallocation of resources by global capitalism." Close quote. Environmental destruction. The only thing constant about life on Earth is change. 200 million years ago, a giant landmass began breaking apart to form the separate continents we know today. The continents continue to move past each other, creating earthquakes and tsunamis. Volcanic eruptions transport molten rock from the Earth's interior to the surface, destroying and rebuilding the land. The climate alternately cools and warms, covering the planet with ice and then melting it again. Species come into existence, flourish, and then perish. Because Earth has never been stable, survival requires adaptation to changing conditions. Capitalism's disregard for the environment parallels its disregard for human beings. The single-minded pursuit of profit has depleted the ozone layer, raised carbon dioxide levels, produced widespread toxic pollution, and contributed to species extinction. While increasing the environmental challenges we face, capitalism also blocks our ability to adapt to those challenges. A prime example is the devastation caused by Hurricane Katrina. Excessive burning of fossil fuels has warmed the planet and increased the ferocity of hurricanes. Yet measures to protect people are grossly inadequate. A scientist who investigated the design, construction, and maintenance of the levees of New Orleans concluded, quote, "People didn't die because the storm was bigger than the system could handle, and people didn't die because the levees were overtopped. People died because safety was exchanged for efficiency and reduced cost." Close quote. Some people dismiss concerns about global warming on the basis that warming and cooling cycles are part of the planet's history. This do-nothing attitude is dangerous. Human beings can adapt to change only by paying attention to what is changing and planning how to respond. The ruling class blocks both responses. The first instinct of public officials in any crisis is to cover their butts. The collapse of the World Trade Center on 9/11 released 1 million tons of toxic dust, including 2,000 tons of asbestos. The Environmental Protection Agency denied there was any problem, falsely reassured the public that the air was safe, and failed to conduct an adequate cleanup. While public officials shirk their responsibility, they place inordinate emphasis on individual responsibility. The public is lectured to reduce, reuse, and recycle, while the ruling class does the opposite. Merchants push us to buy goods that are designed to break down or become obsolete, so we will keep on buying. Recycling at the point of production happens only when it is profitable. Individuals are condemned for littering, while employers dump on a massive scale because dumping is cheaper than safe disposal or recycling. Between World War II and 1970, the U.S. military dumped millions of pounds of toxic nerve gas and mustard gas, along with 400,000 chemical-filled bombs, landmines, rockets, and tons of radioactive water in more than 26 sites off the coasts of at least 11 states. No one knows the exact location of these sites, let alone their impact. Meanwhile, the most toxic material on Earth is flowing from the Hanford nuclear waste dump towards the Columbia River, while the federal government pretends it isn't happening. The capitalist class can't conserve natural resources any more than a hungry bear can be convinced not to eat his dinner. Capitalists treat natural resources like commodities, where greater use brings higher profits. To boost sales, all energy companies offer lower rates to their higher use industrial customers. In 2005, Yankee Gas Services in Connecticut requested a rate increase because customer conservation efforts had caused its profits to drop. Capitalism blocks the development of clean and renewable energy sources. There is no technical reason why solar power chips could not be as plentiful as computer chips. However, the capitalist class prefers that society be dependent on oil and nuclear power for political reasons. Whoever controls oil controls those who need it, and nuclear power plants provide material for nuclear weapons. For those reasons, the capitalist class will never allow alternate sources of energy to replace oil and nuclear power. Challenges are part of life. To survive, we need a social system that helps us to meet those challenges. Capitalism can solve only one problem: how to accumulate capital. By preventing people from solving life's problems, capitalism is leading humanity to extinction. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Descent into barbarism. The capitalist system works perfectly for what it was designed to do: accumulate capital. The cost of this single-minded obsession in human terms is barbarism. The more capital accumulates in private hands, the more civil society breaks down. While the majority of people scramble to survive, the two items that dominate world trade are drugs and weapons. Barbarism is expressed in the enslavement of human beings. In the 21st century, more than 12 million people work as slaves, generating over $30 billion a year in profit. Barbarism is revealed in mass deprivation. 40% of the world's population have no access to clean water, and half the world's children live in extreme poverty. In 2003, more than 50 nations were worse off than they were 10 years earlier. Life expectancy is plummeting in AIDS-plagued nations, erasing decades of progress. Instead of producing life-saving medicines, scientists create chemical and biological weapons. Barbarism is marked by growing investment in means of destruction. The United States is the world's leading arms exporter, selling $6 billion worth of weaponry in 2003 alone. Nearly $1 billion worth of those weapons went to nations torn by civil war. According to the World Policy Institute, quote, 20 of the top 25 U.S. arms clients in the developing world in 2003, a full 80%, were either undemocratic regimes or governments with records of major human rights abuses, close quote. Barbarism is undeniable in the trampling of civil rights, secret prisons, systematic torture, and the preference for force over negotiation. America claims the right to attack any nation or government that threatens its interests. A Pentagon document leaked to the Los Angeles Times listed 7 nations against which the U.S. would be prepared to use nuclear weapons: China, Russia, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Syria, and Libya. The document also outlined 4 possible scenarios where the U.S. should be prepared to press the button: in an Arab-Israeli conflict, in a war between China and Taiwan, in an attack by North Korea on South Korea, and in an attack by Iraq on Israel or another neighbor. Those who doubt the willingness of the capitalist class to destroy the future should look at its readiness to destroy the past. Iraq, called Mesopotamia by the ancient Greeks, is known as the cradle of civilization because its culture dates back more than 7,000 years. In The Smash of Civilizations, Chalmers Johnson describes the greatest cultural disaster of the last 500 years. Quote, on April 10, 2003, in a television address, President Bush acknowledged that the Iraqi people are, quote, the heirs of a great civilization that contributes to all humanity, close quote. Only 2 days later, under the complacent eyes of the U.S. Army, the Iraqis would begin to lose that heritage in a swirl of looting and burning, close quote. The National Museum in Baghdad was robbed of its ancient treasures. The museum's entire collection of ancient writings was stolen, including the earliest writings ever discovered. The torching of the National Library and the Library of Qurans destroyed 1 million books and 10 million ancient documents, all irreplaceable. More than 10,000 important archaeological sites in Iraq remain unprotected. How could such a disaster happen? The illegal trade in antiquities is the 3rd most profitable international trade item, after arms sales and drug smuggling. Before the U.S. invaded Iraq, American scholars, museum directors, art collectors, and antiquities dealers met with Pentagon officials who reassured them that Iraq's historical sites and museums would be protected. However, a group of New York-based collectors and dealers lobbied Washington and the Pentagon, arguing that more private trade in Iraqi artifacts would provide the best security for them. When the invasion of Iraq began, the only building that the U.S. forces actually defended was the Ministry of Oil. As American troops watched, the world's cultural heritage was torched by vandals and looted to stock the vaults of rich collectors. Closer to home, a jewel of American culture, the city of New Orleans, was also destroyed when the people in power did nothing to protect it. The question we need to ask is not whether the capitalist class can save humanity, but who will save humanity from the capitalist class? The middle class. Could the middle class lead humanity to a better future? Middle class professionals see themselves as natural leaders and advisors. They have more education than the average person and display a personal confidence that comes from commanding others. Some have influence with people in power or like to think they have. Professionals and student professionals often head movements for social justice. Unfortunately, the qualities that make a good professional are the opposite of those needed to challenge capitalism. The ruling class needs its managerial class to be loyal. If employers had to watch their managers the same way they watch workers, there would be no point in having managers. The professional is expected to carry out the boss's wishes when the boss isn't there. In other words, professionals must embrace the goals of their superiors as if they were their own. Professional schools are designed to ensure that graduates accept this social role, as I discovered in medical school. My first few months of medical school were very exciting. It was 1970, and our class was going to change the world. We named our student lounge after Norman Bethune and put up a poster of Che Guevara. Our heroes were doctors like Bethune, Che, Virchow, Sigarist, and Salvador Allende, who had just been elected president of Chile by a vibrant workers' movement. 3 years later, everything had changed. The economy was in recession. A U.S.-backed military coup had murdered Allende and crushed the Chilean workers' movement. If any of us were still rebels, we kept it to ourselves. One outspoken student was forced to repeat her year. A more stubborn one was turfed out. Another dropped out. In my last year of medical school, I got into trouble for telling a patient that she had almost died from a medical error. She had been given a medicine to which she was allergic, but the higher-ups decided not to tell her in order to avoid a lawsuit. I was concerned that if she ever had that medicine again, she would likely die, so I told her the truth. I had been taught and believed that the patient's welfare comes first. Silly me. The school convened a committee to decide if I should be allowed to graduate. Fortunately, a sympathetic professor interceded on my behalf, reassuring her colleagues that the problem was, quote, a lack of professional socialization, close quote, and that she would take care of it. Afterwards, she told me that I needed to learn to play the game. That was when I realized that medical school had two functions: to teach me the skills that I needed to work as a doctor, and more importantly, to ensure that I would be loyal to my superiors regardless of the needs of my patients. Hospital training provided the perfect brainwashing conditions and the final testing ground for medical graduates. We were run off our feet, deprived of sleep and food, dominated, interrogated, humiliated, and confined to the building for days at a time. Our heads were stuffed with facts. We were taught to give the, quote, right answers. We were expected to question, but not to question, our superiors. We did as they said, even when we thought they were wrong. We learned to cover their butts and our own. At graduation, my formerly diverse class looked and talked the same. Somewhere along the way, we had traded our dreams of social change for money and status. We were the successful products of the professional training system. Dreams for Sale. In Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives, Jeff Schmidt explains that most students enter professional schools with a dream of making the world a better place. By the end of their training, quote, deep down, something has changed. Students who once spoke critically of the system are careful not to be provocative, not to do or say anything that might displease individuals in authority. Any opposition is now sufficiently abstract and theoretical not to be provocative, close quote. Whether they are physicists, journalists, doctors, political scientists, psychologists, or engineers, the professional is trained to be an obedient thinker, an intellectual property whom employers can trust to experiment, theorize, innovate, and create safely within the confines of an assigned ideology. Those who question the social context of their work are accused of having a political agenda. Those who keep their heads down are promoted. Professionals are expected to uphold class divisions and social hierarchies. For members of oppressed groups, the price of admission to the professional class is the willingness to discriminate against members of your own group or go along with that discrimination. The racist, sexist, and homophobic attitudes that pervade professional schools pressure minority, female, and gay students to swallow their dignity and to pressure their fellows to do the same. This happens in medical schools as well as police academies. Only 3% of physicians in the United States are black. Despite their own experience of racism in the medical profession, studies show that black physicians are just as likely as white physicians to discriminate against black patients. A study of 4,000 Medicare patients found that white patients were significantly more likely than black patients to receive a preferred treatment for heart attack, regardless of whether the physician was black or white. What would account for such a finding? Students who apply to professional schools are put through a rigorous selection and training process designed to exclude those who challenge the status quo. Black students who want to become doctors must put loyalty to the profession first. Those who challenge racist practices are pushed out. The successful graduate is a middle-class professional who is willing to ration medical care on the basis of race, class, and gender, or who goes along with that rationing. Breaking ranks. Professionals are squeezed between the demands of their employers and the needs of those they manage. As a result, managers who lack professional training can be pulled apart. One of my patients found herself in this dilemma when she was promoted to supervisor. Janice was under pressure from the boss to increase production, but she didn't want her former co-workers to dislike her. There was no way to please both sides. The stress mounted, and she became too sick to work. Professional training is designed to prevent such outcomes by ensuring professional loyalty to the employer. As added insurance, employers prefer to hire professionally trained staff from outside the company, putting another barrier in the way of people working their way up. Despite their rigorous training, some professionals will break ranks and switch sides. Whoever warned against the fury of a woman scorned has never felt the wrath of an employer betrayed. After Disciplined Minds was published, Schmidt was fired from his 19-year position as editor of Physics Today. In 1971, military analyst Daniel Ellsberg decided that his first duty was to the public, so he sent confidential government documents to the New York Times. The Pentagon Papers exposed the lies that Washington was telling about the war in Vietnam and helped to turn the public against the administration and against the war. Ellsberg was charged with theft, conspiracy, and espionage. However, all charges were dropped when it was revealed that one group of federal agents had broken into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office to steal information to use against him, and another group of agents had been assigned to kill him. Assassinating Ellsberg would have sent a powerful message to other government employees not to switch sides. Rachel Carson was a whistleblower who worked as a marine biologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Her 1962 classic, Silent Spring, documented the damaging environmental impact of DDT and other pesticides. To discredit Carson, the chemical industry threatened any publisher or publication that promoted her findings. She was labeled a, quote, spinster communist, a lesbian, and a scientific amateur, close quote. To counter Carson's, quote, distorted account, the American Medical Association referred doctors with questions about pesticides to the chemical industries who produced them. In Fast Food Nation, Eric Schlosser describes the smear campaign against his expose of the fast food industry. Despite his meticulous research, Schlosser was denounced as a dunce and an economics ignoramus. His logical conclusions were dismissed as a hodgepodge of impressions, statistics, anecdotes, and prejudices, and he was condemned as a health fascist. When Barbara Ehrenreich described the conditions of America's working poor in Nickel and Dimed, her book was condemned as a classic Marxist rant and a work of intellectual pornography with no redeeming characteristics. Ehrenreich herself was lambasted as an antichrist and a dedicated enemy of the American family for arguing that families headed by single women deserve the same social support as families headed by married couples. When professionals criticize the system, they step over the line that capitalism warns them not to cross. As a result, most books that critique society deliver toothless endings. A good example is The Politics of Cancer, in which Samuel Epstein documents the harm caused by industrial pollution, concluding, quote, "We must be willing to accept the fundamental reality that a significant reduction to exposure to environmental carcinogens will result only from organized political action," close quote. He then does an abrupt turn and offers 16 pages of suggestions on how individuals can reduce their risk of getting cancer. Among other things, he advises, quote, "If you can possibly avoid it, do not live close to a chemical plant, refinery, asbestos plant, or metal mining, processing, or smelting plant, or hazardous waste disposal site, even if it claims to be well managed. Also avoid living close to major highways and expressways," close quote. People do not choose to live in polluted industrial areas. They do so because they cannot afford to live anywhere else. Epstein's suggestions blame the victim for getting in the way of capitalist pollution. He also warns, quote, "Unless you are fully and completely prepared to take the consequences, you should not go to work in an uncontrolled, high-risk industry, especially one with a bad track record," close quote. In reality, people are forced to work at dangerous jobs in order to feed their families. Try telling the families of the dead Sago miners that their loved ones should have worked somewhere else. Regardless of how thoroughly professionals document the insanity of capitalism, an invisible barrier prevents them from rejecting the system altogether. When the next logical step will take them over that line, there is intense pressure to back off and propose solutions that, according to their own analysis, cannot work. I could not understand this phenomenon until I found myself balking at crossing that line and risking my own middle-class privileges by writing this book. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. Damage control. When social conditions deteriorate to the point that whole sections of the middle class threaten to revolt, higher-level managers ensure that lower-level managers remain loyal, as this Canadian example reveals. Underfunded medical services stress patients and the professionals who treat them. By 1998, 62% of Canadian physicians reported that their workload was too heavy, and more than half said that their family and personal life were suffering. By 2003, 46% of doctors were in an advanced phase of burnout, that is, the feeling that they are ineffective, emotionally overrun, and exhausted by their work, and showing clear signs of depersonalization in relationships, close quote. The Canadian Medical Association, CMA, attributed these problems to higher workloads, inadequate resources, and loss of control over how medical care is provided. Warning that the healthcare system and those of us who work in it have been seriously traumatized, the CMA pleaded for more funds for the medical system. When moral persuasion proved ineffective, the CMA did not fight for more funding. That would have been unprofessional. Instead, the CMA did an about-turn to provide damage control for the system. The president of the CMA stated, quote, "Occupational stress and burnout have become facts of life, and physicians owe it to ourselves and our families to look after our own health," close quote. The CMA launched a national program to help doctors cope with stressful working conditions and requested government fund research to answer questions like, quote, "Why does one physician burn out while his colleagues cope well?" close quote. Similar pressures in the United States caused the Joint Committee for the Accreditation of Health Organizations to set new standards requiring hospitals to identify and manage matters of individual physician health. Doctors were advised that the key to managing stress is, quote, "putting yourself first, staying healthy, and paying prompt attention to illness. If you do that, no one gets impaired," close quote. In Britain, psychologists study the learning style of doctors to identify which ones are more likely to burn out at work. None of these measures solve the problem of too few people being expected to do too much work. Because professionals are trained not to question the system, the professional response to social problems has a predictable pattern. The problem is identified and sincere concern is expressed. Along with a genuine desire to help, the healthcare system and those of us who work in it have been seriously traumatized. When moral pressure fails to affect change, the professional switches stride. The status quo is accepted. Occupational stress and burnout have become facts of life, and the problem is redefined. Those being victimized are expected to adjust to the new reality. Putting yourself first, staying healthy, and paying prompt attention to illness. Those who succumb to stressful conditions are blamed. Those who follow recommendations will not become impaired. And finally, an appeal for help is made to the source of the problem, requesting government-funded research to address the symptoms of a government-created crisis. More funds could be obtained for the medical system by organizing a united front composed of all medical workers, doctors, nurses, technicians, orderlies, cleaners, kitchen staff, clerical workers, patients and their families, in short, a class fight. Regardless of how effective such a strategy would be, proposals for united action are dismissed as unprofessional. Professionals are programmed to uphold social divisions, not to break them down. The working class. A dozen CEOs are meeting and the light goes out. It's not their problem, and they find another room. A dozen professionals are meeting, and the light goes out. They wait for someone to come from maintenance. They discuss the importance of light and how frustrating it is not to have it. A dozen workers are meeting, and the light goes out. They fix the light. The working class is the only class that society cannot do without. Workers make everything possible. Jane drives the bus. Jorge removes garbage, Maria constructs furniture, and Mike installs plumbing. Without their daily efforts, the world would grind to a halt. Capitalism created the working class. Before capitalism, most people were farmers. The capitalist revolution forced peasants off the land and into factories. Now the working class is the majority of humanity. By demanding higher productivity, capitalism has forced the working class to produce enough surplus to end human deprivation. Finally, the spread of capitalism throughout the world has created an international working class. These three characteristics make the interests of the working class identical with the interests of humanity. The majority. Workers are not only the majority class in terms of numbers, they are the most organized class. Regardless of where they were born, the color of their skin, what language they speak, who they vote for, what church they attend or don't attend, their age, sex, and sexual orientation, workers do all of the socially necessary work in society, and they do it together. Despite the divisions and competition imposed by capitalism, cooperation is essential to the workers' daily experience. On the assembly line of a car factory or a fast food restaurant, workers must cooperate to create the finished product. Workers must also cooperate to defend themselves against the employer's demands. This necessity for cooperation has produced the working class slogans, "An injury to one is an injury to all," and "United we stand, divided we fall." These principles fit the needs of humanity equally well. As the organized majority, the working class offers the best hope for humanity to liberate itself from capitalism. The producing class. We live in a world shaped by human labor. Goods, services, money, capital all represent units of human labor. Under capitalism, the working class does not produce for itself, but for the capitalist class. The capitalist forces the worker to exchange the collective power to produce for the individual, quote, power to consume. However, the real power of workers lies not in their wallets, but in their ability to stop producing for profit and to start producing for need. When the working class produces to meet its own needs, it also produces to meet humanity's needs, because the two are indistinguishable. By taking collective control of production, the working class could end class divisions and unite humanity in the common project of managing society. The international class. The international working class already runs the world for capitalism. Computers are manufactured by Chinese workers, assembled by Mexican workers, sold by American workers, and serviced by Indian workers. The working class is international. Every major city contains workers from many different nations. Youngsters around the world watch the same movies, listen to the same music, eat the same fast food, and wear the same clothes. However, the persistence of national borders prevents the global integration of humanity. By organizing across national borders, the working class could put an end to war and raise everyone's living standards. Unlike the capitalist class and the middle class, the working class has no interests that conflict with the interests of humanity as a whole. The greatest obstacle to majority rule is the belief that it would never work. Fortunately, beliefs can change. The next chapter explores how the working class could take control of society. Summary: class divisions block humanity from solving pressing problems. The ruling class' obsession with profit endangers human survival. The middle class lacks the power to challenge the ruling class. Only the working class has the size, the organization, and the ability to free humanity from capitalism.